Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So, yes, you heard me right before the news. My next guest does not want to be called a breast cancer survivor. Yes, she says a survivor is someone who's had a brush with death, and what she had was more like a postcard from death with the words "thinking of you." And yes, she really does compare her cancer to punks tossing beer cans out the car window while careening down the highway. Shelley Lewis was last year for her last book called Naked Republicans. This one is just a little different, called Five Lessons I Didn't Learn from Breast Cancer and One Big Thing I Did, or One Big One I Did. We will also talk some presidential politics in a little while. But hi, Shelley Lewis. Thanks for coming on WNYC again.
It's so nice to see you. Thank you.
Punks tossing beer cans out the car window while careening down the highway?
Well, that's really not – that's. I think that was a description of microcalcifications, which are the little debris thrown off often when cells are dividing really, really fast. And they're a marker. They're a sign. They can be a sign that there's a tumor somewhere near present.
And you also write that breast cancer is not the new Woodstock. Are there people who think it is?
Well, you know, it was my experience, and I found out I had it sort of weeks after we launched Air America Radio. I was really busy with other things. I really was not, you know, in any way thinking it could happen
to
me.
You were the founding news director of Air America.
The news director. And there were Liz Winstead and I were the two programming programmers, and I did the news and the talk, and she did the funny. That, you know, that's how it sort of worked out.
And so you had just started that in 2004.
Right. And once I found out I had breast cancer, which was a huge denial issue anyway for me, I couldn't even say it, actually. I would tell people the first day, I have to have a lumpectomy. And they'd say, does that mean you have breast cancer? And I'd say, you know, I guess, apparently. It was quite a shock to the system. But once I learned that, so many of my friends said, oh, I know so-and-so who had it. Everybody has it now. It's this thing. And, you know, it just sort of struck me as, all right, is this our new rite of passage for baby boomers? And I didn't want that. I didn't want it to be part of the
growing up. Why not? Why isn't that comforting to think of it as a rite of passage or the new Woodstock?
Well, it isn't comforting because when it's you, it doesn't matter who else it was. It's you. And I say in the book that if you remember being a little kid, if you're a baby boomer, and you remember lining up for polio shots, seeing the kid in front of you get it and the one in front of him and the one in front of her, and they're crying, you don't not cry when it's your turn. It hurts. And it actually, in some ways, makes it worse because you see that what they're going through. And I felt very much as though there was an expectation of how one does breast cancer in this country and that there really is a script. And I really don't like scripts very much. I like to wing it. And
you like to critique other people's scripts, I know.
Oh, Brian.
But the whole thing is that you are really contrarian about the language that people are using here, right? So you also say in this book you don't want to say that you battled cancer. You're skeptical of the so-called breast cancer community.
Well, you know, there are yes and no. I mean, I do feel there is this whole pink ghetto, you know, that not you might just have it, and it's a disease, and you go through it, and you have lots of friends and loved ones and medical people who help you, and you read books, and there's tons of stuff, thank God, out there. But maybe you don't do it as one of the people who sort of joins support groups or joins clubs. Maybe it's just, you know, if you had some other disease, you wouldn't be looking for a club to join, as it were. And I didn't. I mean, I did it really on my own as much as I could. And believe me, it may sound like I'm a contrarian, and I wrote it because I didn't hear a lot of other people talking about this. But I assure you, there are many, many women who just want to get over the disease, get treated and move back to their lives, and who aren't looking for epiphanies or spiritual transformations. It's a disease, and it's an awful disease, and we should be talking more about it in a serious way. I'm not minimizing at all. In fact, I think the opposite. We need to do a lot more talking about it, but I think we need to talk about it in ways that are not sugar-coated or pink-wrapped.
So breast cancer... See, now you got me self-conscious. Should I say breast cancer survivors?
Women no, they, who most have women or, call themselves survivors. And you sort of do it because there's not a better term. I mean, I kind of struggled with what do you call yourself?
What do you call yourself?
You know.
Or you just
some
the
dame
idea
who had breast cancer.
Right. No. So if you're some dame who had breast cancer or someone who does, or if you are relating to this, what do you think about Shelley Lewis's take on this? Is this liberating to you in some way? Do you feel at all kind of penned in by the language, the script that you're supposed to use if you have breast cancer? Give us a call. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for the comments page on this battled cancer. You don't like that word battled. And you write that for you, chemo felt sort of like attacking a country because we thought it was a threat even though they had no WMDs. Of course, that never really happens, does it?
Yeah, and WMD is weapons of me destruction in that particular case. But yeah, I
explain that, weapons of me destruction.
Well, chemo, you know, destroys a lot of cells. Chemotherapy was the first chemotherapy was mustard gas. You know, that was the beginning of chemotherapy, and it was, as most good discoveries are, it was a pure accident. I think it was discovered that soldiers who were exposed to it had very low white cells, and some smart doctors said, wow, this might work on lymphoma, and it took them a long time to get it, you know, to get it right. But yeah, I mean, chemo is your body is a battleground. I think the word, to say you're a warrior, or to me, we're not soldiers. We're not facing what our men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan are facing. It's very different for us.
You don't want to minimize what they're going through.
In fact, just the opposite. I don't want to minimize either side, but but to me, it's different. And I think when you just have a word and you don't think about the word a lot, you do yourself a disservice and you do the other people a disservice. I think we're so looking for buzzwords and metaphors. And why don't we just talk about it and talk about what it really is and talk about what the best things are to do to get treatment if you have it. But for me, to learn what causes it and how to prevent it is something that is not talked about nearly enough, and something I would like to see talked about and dealt with and researched much more actively.
Eileen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Shelley Lewis, author of Five Lessons I Didn't Learn from Breast Cancer and One Big One I Did. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I've also had breast cancer, and I can sympathize completely with your reaction because I was very much the same way. I didn't even tell anybody except my husband that I even found the lump because I was sure it was going to be benign. So then when it turned out that it wasn't, I was furious. And I have this well-meaning sister-in-law who wanted to delve into my feelings. And I said, I'm angry. And she just wasn't accepting that. And I said, you know what? I don't even need to talk to these people.
Good for you.
I didn't join any support. I didn't need a support group. This is what I have to do. The path is clear in front of me. But one of the frustrations I found was the amount of information and trying to get your arms around it was just completely overwhelming. And I'm a very much control freak. So I finally came to the conclusion, I need to find an oncologist that I trust and just go with what he or she says. And that's how I approached it.
You know, and I can completely sympathize. The first chapter of my book is called Take Human Bites. And you might remember that commercial for a play called Gemini in the 70s where a woman is smacking her son upside the head and saying, take human bites.
Very much.
And I really think that the first thing you want to do, and I'm a huge control freak, is to just dive into the web and read everything. And it's overwhelming. And you know, it's just what worked for me, and I'm no expert, but what worked for me and what I can say could be very helpful is take it one step at a time. The first thing you have to do is find a surgeon who you trust, who will listen to you, who will not make you feel that your questions are silly, and who you that's not the person you're going to spend a huge amount of time with, but he or she is a hugely important person in your life at that moment. And if you can just reach out and find people who can help you with that first step, it's a really good process, part of the process.
Eileen, thank you for your call. Now, the one big lesson that you're right, you did learn was breast cancer doesn't change who you are. It confirms who you are.
It did for me. I mean, look at me. I'm still the contrarian. I am who I am. And, you know, maybe if you have irritable bowel syndrome, it transforms you. You have a spiritual revelation, or maybe if you have kidney disease, but I don't think so. It's just breast cancer carries with it this expectation. What did you learn? What made it all worthwhile? What was the, what are the lessons? And what lessons? I mean, of course you learn things in any big experience that you have, but I did not find it to be transformational. I found it to really validate what I knew about myself to be true. And if I could expand just for a second, the five lessons I didn't learn, what I mean by that title is I brought lessons from my life to breast cancer. I didn't look for breast cancer to teach me things. I felt I had lived many years on this planet, dealt with many different kinds of issues, and that if I use what I had learned in my life in the process of dealing with breast cancer, that would serve me well. And in fact, it did. And I think almost everybody has that. And the lessons that were mine. You could have entirely different ones.
You know, irritable bowel syndrome aside, I think most big life events actually confirm who you are.
I think that's right.
I know people with creaky marriages, for example, who had kids to cement the relationship. But dealing with the kids just brought out the same conflicts they had before, only more, because
right.
then there were kids.
Right.
So breast cancer was sort of like that for you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I dealt with it. I sort of, in the beginning, I kind of started to walk the path that I thought you were supposed to walk on. And very quickly, I thought, no, I don't like this. And no, I'm not going to do it that way. And sometimes it was big things and sometimes it was little things. I didn't get a second opinion, for example. I loved the doctor who gave me her opinion as the first one. I thought from what I had read, she was exactly right. And, did I want someone to give me a competing opinion so that I then had to get a third opinion? No, I didn't. So even though, you always hear, well, you got to get a second opinion, maybe you do and maybe you don't.
Shelley Lewis, my guest on WNYC, with her book, Five Lessons I Didn't Learn from Breast Cancer, and One Big One I Did. And Jeff in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Ms. Lewis. My concern is that there's a history to this model, and I believe that the prototype emerges out of the gay community's response to the AIDS epidemic.
Right.
And I believe that when you have a disease that is stigmatizing a group of people, I believe that the generation of a community around that, and of course, there are multiple ways that people respond, but information gathering, information sharing, creations of networks, all of those things are positive developments, and as I'm sure you'll acknowledge, they have changed the face
Absolutely.
Of disease management in this country as a result.
Absolutely, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, in fact, it's interesting, and I do write about this, that the breast cancer awareness movement did come from the HIV/AIDS awareness movement, and the AIDS movement, I have read, came out of the women's health movement of the 70s in Boston, and that
our bodies, ourselves, all
exactly,
that.
Exactly. And I'm not saying it's fantastic that there are tons of support groups, tons of organizations that can help women with breast cancer to learn what they need to know. I am all in favor of that. I actually think that it stops a little too soon, and that there are expectations that are more emotional. We need to have tons and tons of emotional support. But I think that there's this feeling like, oh, it'll be okay, pat, here you go, off you go, and that's really not for everybody.
You have a whole section of this book called Our Bodies, But Not Ourselves. What does that mean?
Well, what do you think it means?
Well, it means that your personhood is not defined by your body.
Exactly. And for women who lose a piece of their body, that's, I think, an important thing to remember.
And you trace, and related to Jeff's call, you trace the term breast cancer survivor back to 1986. So did it grow directly out of the people with HIV movement?
There was a person, I mean, an organization, a survivors organization that was not, that was a cancer survivors organization, and they coined the phrase, and then it was picked up by the government. I don't remember whether it was NIH or one of the other agencies, and incorporated into their literature and language. You know, survivor is a great term if that's what you want to use, and I don't judge anybody for any way they want to handle it. It isn't really right for me, and it isn't right for, there are other women who say the same thing, but the vast majority of cancer survivors call themselves cancer survivors.
You're right that you'd rather be called an advocate,
yes,
than survivor. Why advocate?
Well, because I think that, and this goes to who I am as a person, I believe that when something, you know, when you have raised your own personal awareness, and then you can therefore help raise somebody else's, you can lobby, you can vote, you can do things, you can write a book to sort of bring up what you consider to be important and to advocate for people who you feel are not getting all that they need for all that is done for breast cancer. I think there are certain things that are sort of left to the side.
You know, in that light, it was interesting to me that you came out in this book against a bill before Congress called the Breast Cancer Patient Protection Act, which would guarantee mastectomy patients can stay in the hospital for at least 2 days.
Right. And I think that mastectomy patients should. I think that the organizations that do not support it, and they don't necessarily oppose it, and that's really where I fall. It's not that I oppose it. I just, it wouldn't be where I would put my personal efforts. It's because why should breast cancer get favored treatment? There are lots and lots of other kinds of cancer and other illnesses that face the same insurance problems, and it seems to me and to the other groups that argue about this that everybody should be included and that breast cancer should not be singled out.
Of course, sometimes that's how we have to fight the insurance companies. We never got to universal health care,
right,
by proposing universal health care in America. We've managed to cover old people with Medicare, poor people with Medicaid, children with SCHIP. Maybe that incremental approach is all we've got until some kind of sanity sets in.
You know, maybe. And sometimes what you do when you write a book is you raise a contrarian point of view to get people talking. And if you do that, that's good, too.
Joanne in Sleepy Hollow, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I'm calling because I just completed a very aggressive course of treatment, chemotherapy, radiation, and a year-long drug trial for bilateral triple-negative breast cancers, a very serious kind of breast cancer.
Right.
But two things. One is that I wanted to share great perspective that I got from the social worker at the hospital where I was treated when I consulted her about how to communicate with my son. She said, cancer is a word like fruit, and that's a meaningless word. There are grapes and there are watermelons. What you have is a grape. Pancreatic cancer, now that's a watermelon.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And the other thing is that throughout this treatment, I was rather unnerved by the cancer patients around me who had seized upon this experience as a kind of previously lacking identity. And I was saddened and troubled by that and still kind of wrestling with what that means. And that's all I wanted to add to the comment.
Okay.
How are you feeling now?
Oh, I feel great.
Good. Good, good, good.
Thank you, Joanne. And on this notion of grapes and watermelons, I mean, the whole premise of our conversation so far, I think unspoken, has been that you're basically okay now.
I'm fine, as far as I know. You're always fine till you find out you're not.
Till you find
but
out you're
yeah,
not.
Yeah, I think I'm fine.
But there are people who are not breast
right.
cancer survivors who actually die from it.
That's right. 40,000. And actually, that's the piece of it that really is maddening to me, that every year 40,000 women in America die of breast cancer, and every year 170 some thousand women are diagnosed with it, and the vast majority will survive and live to fight another day or obsess about their age or whatever it is we do, but there are tons of women. It's shocking that how little attention, I believe, when every October, how much time is really spent on on stories about the women who didn't make it. And so when I hear women say, oh, it was a gift, I felt so lucky, it makes me crazy, because it's not lucky.
And you are very you in this book with your snarky contrarian attitude. I mean, you write about breast cancer, your own breast cancer, no less, almost in the same tone that you wrote your last book called Naked Republicans, which people can figure that, you know, what that's about. But is anybody offended by you taking a cheeky approach to breast cancer, or do you think everybody's beyond that?
Well, you can never say everybody's beyond anything. We still have people who believe in, you know, a flat earth, apparently. So I would make no assumptions.
You haven't had any feedback like that.
I have not had any like, what are you talking about? In fact, like your callers, for the most part, most women I have spoken to, and I've been to book clubs and other groups, have said, thank you so much for talking about some of the other things that really don't get talked about a lot in the media.
We have a few minutes left, and let me ask you to put on your political media hat for a minute. You've been the executive producer of Good Morning America and CNN's American Morning and vice president of Air America Radio. How do you see the end game for Hillary Clinton, assuming you think this is the end game?
My guess is that she will, and I don't know, but I have talked to pundits, as they say, who are pretty well connected. It seems as though they're trying to find a graceful way out. You know, she's got a lot of debt that could be retired. She's got positions.
Does Obama have the ability to do that as the presumptive nominee, to retire the debt through Democratic Party funds?
You know, I don't know how. I mean, I know they're talking about it, and I don't know whether it's through funds he's got or through funds they would have to raise. Mm-hmm. I also think that, really, if the Clintons wanted to raise millions of dollars to retire her debt, they could do that. You know, I think that will happen.
So debt is one issue.
Debt is an issue. I think the Clintons' legacy is an issue. You know, I was really so disturbed by how Bill Clinton behaved at times, and I want to go back to really liking him. And I really do. And I know there are a lot of other liberal Democrats who feel the same way.
Do you see her as a potential vice presidential candidate?
I just don't. Do you? I mean, when you look at their body language, I can't imagine. I know there are people who are saying that it's a dream ticket, and in some ways it would be, but really, it's hard for me to imagine.
We had a guest, Marie Coco, earlier in the show, who said it was hard for her to imagine because Clinton and so many other women in America would resent her being number two to
right,
a man
right.
after all that she's done.
Right.
You think?
I definitely think there are women who would say, oh, see, glass ceiling. Yes, I do think that, even though she couldn't, as they say, close the deal herself either.
So how do they bring back all of those Democrats who feel so strongly for her that they've been telling pollsters they wouldn't vote for Obama?
Well,
what's the path?
You know, that every year, that every election cycle that happens, there are people who say that. I think the path, you saw it the other night if you were watching election coverage all night long, as I was. And you see,
I was live blogging election coverage.
Well, then you were watching and thinking at the same time, which I didn't have to do. but what I did notice, what it appeared that both gave speeches which were a bit conciliatory, and that their supporters will take their cues from the candidates themselves. And in the end, the women who support Hillary Clinton, I find it's hard to imagine that they would support John McCain with his anti-choice attitude and the idea that he would be nominating Supreme Court judges. I just think that in the end, people will, to use the cliche, come home to
the party. Do you think there's any other role? I mean, everybody just talks about vice president or nothing, it seems to me. Maybe there's some other role. Maybe it's secretary of state or who knows what in an Obama administration.
Absolutely. Or failing that, there are people who are saying she could become the Senate majority leader. She could sort of, and then there are people who, you probably know this better than I do, because you pay more attention to New York politics, but there's all this talk about her being governor of New York.
Why would she want that?
I can't imagine. I'm still
trying to figure out why John Corzine wanted to leave the Senate and run New Jersey.
I know.
All right. Shelley Lewis, her new book is called Five Lessons I Didn't Learn from Breast Cancer, and one big one I did. Another one that she says she learned was that it's sometimes good to lie to yourself. That
lie to yourself, denial is your best friend at times.
Shelley, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute, how you can help the survivors of the cyclone in Myanmar. Stay with us.